Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Daniel Ellsberg from January 4th, 2001. Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, discusses the destabilization of Pakistan, how counterinsurgencies often provoke civil war, and the underestimation of Israel's nuclear arsenal. This is about an hour. And then after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Kohlberg. This is about 27 minutes.
That's racist to say that Vietnamese are human. Come on, Dan. Get with the program.
I'm suggesting, I'm mentioning this to say it's a good question to ask any of the military or of Obama at a press conference right now. What's the best estimate you've received of the number of people who will die in Afghanistan in the next 12 years? 12 months. Or 12 years, but that would be better. But let's say 12 months. From our policy. What's the estimate? I certainly have estimates of how many troops we're putting over, what our casualties will be, what everything, how many people will be killed. And actually, he backtracked on that 10 ways. He says, well, what's your alternative? And I said, I'm not talking options here and alternatives. I know all about that. I'm just saying, what's the effect of your policy? And of course, I asked that knowing, and I've even checked up on it before answering it. They had never asked that question. They don't have an estimate. They don't make an estimate of that. And they may or may not have a secret calculation of how many they've already killed. They may claim they haven't because they don't want it to leak. But they may actually have done that. And they certainly haven't let us know in Iraq. We've seen estimates, you know, the highest estimate that Bush ever gave was 40,000.
Right.
Which was impressive because that is 10 times 9/11. And it's larger than they'd admitted up till now. It was probably an underestimate by at least an order of magnitude, a factor of 10. At the very least, at that time, that would be about 400,000. But the better estimates really were that even at that time, that there was something like a million who had been killed. And that was back in 2006.
Yeah.
So since then, very much more than that. I'm saying, in other words, that the estimates you do get are underestimates by 10 to 100 times. And that is what really has to be taken into account when we look at where we're going and challenged. Obama, really, as we come here to the start of a new year and a new decade, I think it's time, in my own mind, to have come to a kind of bottom line appraisal of him. Which is very dark, actually, in my opinion. There's really two views when you look at his behavior in many spheres. And one is that he's very weak, that he's cowardly, that he avoids conflict aversive, and that the last person to talk to him, which seems always to be the right wing or the military, he bends in their direction, and he can't confront anybody. That may be true. There, maybe that's the answer. I'm inclined more and more to think that he has been a con man all this time, and that the notion that he's somehow on our side, progressive or even liberal in any real sense, is very misleading. And that when the Wall Street people found him and backed him in the very beginning, Wall Street money, I think, was what got him started before the Internet chimed in, and then they, in the end, Wall Street and insurance companies, military industrial complex, oil, all kicked in much more than the Internet people altogether. And I think it's not so much that he's doing their bidding, they knew who he was.
Sure, I mean, come on. I mean, we're talking about a guy who won the nomination of one of the two major parties in America to be the president, which means that he's a serial killer. They wouldn't give him the job if he wasn't willing to use robots to bomb women and children off the face of the earth. He wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the power. I mean, let's go back to 2007 real quick. There was Gravel and there was Kucinich in the Democratic Party who were running for president and were opposed to war. And then there was Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, who, all of whom, were warmongering, lunatic, imperialists, and made it absolutely clear. There was no I don't think anyone could mistake Barack Obama for Denis Kucinich on foreign policy even a year and a half before he was elected.
Well, that's right. His largest private contributor before the campaign was Goldman Sachs. And his people in Goldman Sachs has gotten very good service from him, basically. And I think the point is they chose him, basically, because they saw somebody who would conform to a philosophy that's what good for Goldman Sachs is good for the country. Goldman Sachs is, in a way, the new symbol, the new economy, whereas 50 years, when was it? 1950, that's a long time ago, 60 years on, when the head of GM, Charlie Wilson, made the mistake as Secretary of Defense saying, what's good for GM is good for the country. Well, that was GM, that was the old industrial model. And now it's what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for the country. And they're very sincere about that, no doubt. But there is something of a conflict of interest when you're getting these
million-dollar
bonuses, $100 million bonuses in the year. It's easy to understand, gee, this is very good for the country.
Yeah. You know, I think you could probably buy my morality into being quiet for a little while for that much of a bonus. Well, all right. So let me ask you about the most important subject on the planet Earth, and that is the maintenance by the American, British, Russian, Chinese, Pakistani, Indian, and Israeli governments of stockpiles of nuclear weapons. You've been doing this this series for Truthdig, which I guess started with your Hiroshima and Nagasaki article last August, and we've been talking about this on the show a little bit, and there's a couple of directions I want to go on the subject of nuclear weapons. First, Dan, would be the status of negotiations with the Russians. It looks like there was a treaty that, I don't know why they let it expire, but they let this treaty expire, and I don't know exactly what's going on there. I hope that you can help me out with that. And then also, of course, Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli whistleblower who revealed their secret nuclear weapons program, apparently has been rearrested from his house arrest to real arrest, something along those lines. So I guess say whatever you like about either of those topics, please.
Well, as you know, I've had very little sleep today on New Year's Day because late New Year's Eve, and I was celebrating with my son and his fiance and their friends. We were, my wife and I were very honored to be invited to join these young people in their New Year's Eve.
I'm glad you had a good time.
So in the midst of that, I got the worst possible news, or among the worst possible news I could get, which was that my close friend Mordecai Vanunu had been arrested in Israel on grounds, by the way, on which they could have arrested him any time in the last 5 years, and certainly the last several years, and chose for some reason to arrest him now, threatening him then with a 6-month prison, as a, which he has over his head as a suspended sentence, for having associated with foreigners. Now, I'm a foreigner who associated with him on several trips there, and I'll explain to readers who don't know, who listeners who don't know Mordecai in just a moment. But, you know, he's talked to every foreigner possible in the last couple of years, and for some reason they've chosen to get him for dealing with his Norwegian girlfriend at this point, a woman he's been seeing for 2 years, and they've known about it. So he's faced with going back to prison for 6 months on top of 18 years of imprisonment, of which 11 and a half were spent in a 6-by-9-foot cell. It was the longest period of solitary confinement of anybody in the world. Amnesty International called it cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment. And he managed to come out of that, not in the best of shape at the time, but he's recovered a great deal from it mentally, or totally mentally, if you got out.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying that this is...
They want to send him back now.
This trouble, but he hasn't done anything except see his girlfriend and you?
Well, he had talked to every foreigner who comes through for a year, since he got out 5 years ago. But when he got out after serving his full sentence, and let's explain right now, for having revealed to the London Sunday Times photographs that he had taken showing that the nuclear program in Israel, which they don't even admit they have to this day, the nuclear program, which everyone else in the world knew that they did have, was much larger than anybody had estimated, and that even CIA had estimated it all. And he showed that it was larger. Now, they were... that, by the way, is something I've noticed. They're talked about as the sixth after so nuclear power Israel. That's very misleading. Vanunu's point at the time was that the estimate of, say, 200 nuclear weapons, which one often saw for Israel, which would put them behind France, let's say, or England, was actually wrong at that time, that it was probably closer to 600 weapons even then, certainly over 300, or closer to 600 even then. That was in the early 80s, and they've been building weapons ever since. Probably Israel's power puts them as the third country in the world, after the U.S. and Britain, above France, above
Dan, you said that
the numbers of weapons.
You said that Vanunu's estimate is 600 atomic bombs in Israel's arsenal?
That was back in the in the early 80s.
Wow, because, you know, yeah, I guess, as you say there, the usual estimate is a couple of hundred. I guess the Air Force one time released a thing that they said they thought it was maybe 400.
Well, who knows? You know, one would think that, you know, I think the world does deserve to know who the nuclear powers are. That's of world interest. And the people of the country as well. How many weapons do they have? How big are they? And what are they for? Let me put this in the larger context a little bit. I don't think there's a single country in the world, the U.S. or any of the other nine known nuclear powers right now, could justify openly why they have, or their rationale for having, as many weapons as, let's say, India, which might be a couple of hundred, or Britain or France. We have thousands. We have thousands. But what exactly are those to do? Let's take 600 weapons in Israel. It would be very interesting for them to explain to the world how they would use those weapons. And I don't want to focus just on Israel here. Their policy is no more reckless and stupid and criminal than that of every other nuclear state.
Yeah, well, agreed there.
Yeah.
I mean, although at least the rest of them are members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Nuclear Suppliers Group.
Not better, and it's not worse.
Yeah. Now, does Israel have H-bombs, Dan? Do you know?
Yes, now, that was also the other thing that Vanunu revealed, that they almost surely had an H-bomb capability. And so anyway, having revealed that, they kidnapped him. They lured him with a woman to Italy, got into an apartment, beat him up, drugged him, hypodermic needle, put him in a sack essentially, kidnapped him on a boat to Israel and put him in a closed trial in Israel, sentenced him to 18 years. Having served the entire 18 years, not a day off of good behavior, you know, the sentence finished and opened. He's now released under conditions that he can't speak to foreigners. He can't talk to the press. He can't go near an airport or a railroad station or anything like that, or leave the country. Restrictions that were direct, explicit, word-for-word carryover from British mandate. When the British colonial rule in Palestine, preceding the birth of Israel, those regulations were carried over. And at the time, they were tyrannical regulations by any standard. They don't meet any aspect of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as restrictions on somebody who has served a sentence and who is in principle paid his debt, whatever that was, to society. So he has, from the beginning, explicitly then talked to foreigners regularly, talked to journalists regularly, defied that, in effect. And for that, he was sentenced earlier this year, 6 months suspended sentence, meaning that they propose to put him back in prison where he spent the 11 and a half years in solitary confinement. If there's a man in the world who can stand up to that, it's Mordecai Vanunu. He's been tested. He's been through the fire. I would have more confidence in his doing it than I would in myself. But can he do it? Either. Is even he up to that? I don't know. Maybe he doesn't know. As they say, if anybody can do it, he can. But it's outrageous that he should be confronted with that. And in this case, as his lawyers just said, that's all I've been able to find out so far, is that he's been seeing his Norwegian girlfriend. And that's the excuse for consorting with a foreigner. By the way, he was arrested a couple of years ago for going to Bethlehem for a New Year, for a Christmas Eve service. And that was going out of the territorial restrictions that are put on him. He would like to get out of Israel. But anyway,
that's interesting how sometimes the West Bank counts as Israel and sometimes it don't.
That's right. But for purposes of this.
Now, listen, Dan, I'm sorry because we are right up on an hour here. And I want this to, you know, still be within, I want people to still click on it, not see the file is too big to bother with. But I wanted to give you a chance to address the expiration of the START 1 treaty here real quick. And is this, I think I read in the BBC here that Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, was saying it's just technical issues we're still working out. Are we going to have a new version of the START 1 treaty? What
yes.
the hell is the START 1 treaty anyway, exactly?
There will be almost surely a restriction. They will arrive at an agreement limiting, this ties into what we were saying earlier, the significance of it, limiting the number of warheads that we have and that the Russians have down to perhaps from the current ceiling of about 2,300 down to 1,600. Although the earlier ceiling was, by the way, 1,700 to 2,300. So limiting it to 1,600 or 1,650 is a pretty marginal change. But you get it down anyway to 1,600, which sounds better than 2,300. Except when you reflect that 1,000 warheads, as in the piece that I did write on Truth Taker, which is on my website, Ellsberg.net. I think the piece is titled 100 Holocausts. 1,000 warheads is enough to cause nuclear winter. In other words, to blot out the sunlight for long enough to destroy most civilized life in the Northern Hemisphere, possibly in the world, possibly lead to human extinction and extinction of many others. Possibly. A real risk. A serious risk. 1,000. So limiting it to 1,600 means nothing. Nothing. It doesn't reduce the risk to humanity or to anything else. There is no conceivable legitimate justification for having 1,600 warheads and no way to use them that does not threaten ecological catastrophe in not just in a region, but even a war between India and Pakistan involving a total of hundreds of these warheads would involve ecological catastrophe.
Well, and I want to beg everybody to go and read 100 Holocausts, etc., Ellsberg.net and at truthdig.com, and just to look at the chart where it says, you know, this is our estimate of how many hundreds of millions of human beings would die in the first week, the first two, the first four, six weeks.
Finally, to put what you were saying about the arms control agreements, unless and until public pressure forces them down far below 1,600, far below 1,000 each, because 1,000 altogether is enough for total global catastrophe, will you have made any significant change? This is not a significant change so far. And so long as we maintain our first use policies of threatening to initiate nuclear war as against Iran, against their underground sites, a threat that remains on the table in this administration as it did during the campaign. All of those make it impossible to think of other countries being willing to give up their nuclear weapons, especially, as I say, as the U.S. and Russia maintain forces that could lead to ecological catastrophe, forces of thousands, let alone 1,600. So it all remains still to be done. And what's happened so far does not even amount to any progress on the way of what Obama put forth as his goal of the abolition of nuclear weapons, which he then immediately backed off from and said not in his lifetime.
Yeah.
He's not even moving toward that at this point. I would say that's...
Oh, but the first half of the speech was so inspiring, though. You know, it wasn't until the second half of the speech where he admitted that he didn't mean anything he said in the first half.
Well, he gives us the rhetoric, and he gives the Pentagon the reality.
Yeah. All right, everybody, that is Daniel Ellsberg, the man who ended the Vietnam War. I give you credit. I thank you very much, and I recommend everyone please read the excellent book Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and check out Ellsberg.net, and especially check out the series on nuclear weapons for TruthDig.com. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thanks a lot. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.